another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX on 8.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I am your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, and this week's episode is entitled Lifting Off. I've been really excited to do this episode for a very long time, and I think it makes sense to do it now. The last couple of weeks, we've been kind of hovering around this theme of, I guess you'd call it existentialism. We talk about existential ideas all the time on the show, but a couple of weeks ago, we did an episode called The Enemy Within, and we talked about sort of the self-destructive nature of people, and not just individuals, but the human race as a whole. And we particularly put that in the context of geopolitical tensions and talked about Dr. Strangelove and the fact that, you know, what's at stake is really the survival, the persistence of the human race at this point, with things like nuclear weapons and stuff being, you know, existing, and then they could be launched and then landed in all sorts of places by all sorts of actors. And then we also more recently talked about the seeds of war and how war and fighting and destruction are kind of a constant, that we have this illusion based on certain narratives that wars start and end at certain times and they're caused by certain things. But really the truth is that war is a constant, and it's just a matter of, you know, what atrocities you're looking at a given point in history. And I want to talk about what we can do about all that. And not just war and not just the destruction of people by people, but the destruction of people in general. I mean, we talk a lot about existential threats these days, particularly in the context of things like climate change and pandemics and nuclear war and that sort of thing. And some people talk about aliens, some people used to talk about asteroids hitting the Earth, but the current trajectory of the Earth is that it's going to end, which means at this rate, the end of the human race, right? If it's not from any of those things that we just mentioned, you know, if it's not from ChatGPT taking over and we get a Terminator-style situation happening, I mean, eventually the sun is going to engulf the Earth. And even if we are able to leave the Earth, the universe is in a constant state of expansion. So if we want to persist, which I might sound crazy for saying this, but I want us to persist. I want conscious organic beings to exist for the rest of eternity. We have to turn our minds to the fact that our current trajectory is not a good one. And I want to look at some of the lessons that film can provide us in those questions. I think it's a very honorable thing when an artist or a filmmaker of artist of any kind wants to address that kind of question. I mean, in my view, if you want to talk about the end of the human race, your film is immediately at least a 9 out of 10 in my books because of just how important that question is. It's sort of the ultimate sociological or physical philosophical question a person can contemplate. So what are some films that have contemplated that? The first one we're going to talk about is Gattaca from 1997, directed by Andrew Niccol. And we're actually going to use that one kind of as our starting point because it's sort of the counter-argument to everything that we're going to be saying for the rest of the episode, sort of like the reason why maybe human progress isn't something that's desirable. Lifting off sort of being this metaphor in all of the films we're talking about human beings leaving the Earth, or I guess a metaphor for human beings transcending our terrestrial origins, being more than just animals on a speck of dirt, but rather beings that look to overcome and become so much more than just, you know, creatures that are limited by, you know, the Earth, but rather things that can transcend these massive existential threats. So Gattaca, I think, it's kind of the counter to that in a weird kind of way. We're then going to move on to Sunshine from 2007, directed by Danny Boyle. And then we're going to finish off with Christopher Nolan's film from 2014. And that would be Interstellar, of course. We'll be talking about that one this week. But let's get started now with Andrew Niccol's 1997 film Gattaca. Before we get into space exploration, this one's really a film about innovation or the, you know, progression or I guess false progression in society and how, you know, the human civilization can become kind of all too dystopian if we let scientific innovation spiral out of control. The premise of this film is where it's in a future situation where human beings have gotten so adept with genetics and statistics and things like that, where you can pretty much measure what a person's success from their blood when they're born. And we're kind of already able to do that in a lot of ways. But, you know, knowing how smart someone's going to be, whether they're going to be athletic, when they're going to die and that sort of thing, and then kind of siphoning people off into different categories. And it's a really important choice that this film makes, which is it's not the result of an overly centralized, Orwellian government that wants to determine, for the sake of, having a high functioning society, that they go in and in a very authoritarian, totalitarian way, organize everybody like little units. It's actually kind of like private companies, like the private sector. You could say it's an excess of freedom just for certain people, corporations being persons under the law, I suppose, where, if they use that technology, if they have the freedom to use that technology, they then use it to determine who should work for their given company and that sort of thing. And there's a good sequence in the film that explains it much better than that. But Gattaca is the company that Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman's characters work for. And Ethan Hawke is actually pretending to be Jude Law because he actually got into this company and not Ethan Hawke, because Ethan Hawke wants to eventually become, this is where the space part comes into it, become a spaceman and go up into space. Now, it's never really explained where he's going or the purpose of the mission. We're going to talk about that a bit more in a second. But I guess you could say it's a very apt metaphor for him wanting to transcend, to go above, to be more than, what he was categorized into at birth. So there is some kind of value for transcendence and going out into the ether, but it's sort of like it needs to be something that all people can do. And I suppose, so it's not completely against what we're getting at this week, but the film certainly gives us a sense of discomfort around the fact that human beings can become commodified, can be reduced to basic statistics, can be roped off and divided by their immutable differences. Basically, it's a bad thing if prejudice can be brought down to a basic science and used to, what essentially is a way to advance society at the most efficient way possible. And that's kind of the focus of this part of today's conversation, which is that, the cost of wanting human beings to advance as efficiently as possible to deal with these problems head on means that there's going to be a great cost to the human race, which seems that we're going to have to give up a lot of personal freedoms in order to advance. And we see that during wartime, but we also see just in the everyday, like, if a company wants to have the best workers these days, they actually do use something called psychometric testing, where they actually sit people down, they forget about their personality, they get them to do an IQ test on a computer, and they basically go, if you've got an IQ lower than this thing, you're not going to be part of our company. And I mean, even something like during COVID as well, not to say that... Any countries did this, but some countries could have done this if they wanted to, and maybe some did, which is, when we got swabbed, and there's a scene that reminded me of this in the film, because the characters do get swabbed, the DNA on that swab, parted with, coupled with our name and our date of birth, which they had to do in order to get the message back to us, that could have been used by a malevolent government to just go, well, quietly put those over there, we'll do some tests on them, we'll find out who should be where and where they should go, and then we can sort of shuffle society around so those people go here. And those, it is definitely within the realm of possibility now that if a country wants, or organization wants to advance itself, there are some big costs that the individual could bear in the near future, or dare I say the present, that would mean that we can advance things in the grand scheme of things. It's an ends justify the means situation. But again, it would be a massive cost to the individual, and we don't like that. But if there is a flaw to this film, they don't really explore where these rocket ships are going, right? And they don't really put these questions in the context of, what is the greater good here? What is Gattaca actually overall achieving? So to sort of provide a counter-argument to that now, let's move on to Sunshine from 2007, directed by Danny Boyle. And the premise of this film is that there's a group of scientists on their way to save the Earth by going to the sun. And they're going to drop off a bomb in the sun, and that's going to make the sun, because the sun's dying in this future situation, and the Earth is becoming super cold, and they need to warm it up so that the Earth can live on. So we've got an apocalyptic situation going on here, and these are this group of scientists going out into space to save us. And along the way, they have all sorts of issues that they're confronted with, various dilemmas. And you could say the film is a little bit like a first year ethics course, where it's like a bunch of those sort of situations where you've got like two tracks, and it's like if you pull the lever, the train doesn't kill three people, it only kills one person. Is that the ethical thing to do? Because there's lots of, they have lots of moments where they can either, you know, go off course and save some people, or go off here and get some more things, or, you know, this person has to, if we can, you know, if one person decides to die, we have more oxygen and more resources, da 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 da. But it's not just sort of like a meditation on the failures of human rationality in the face of an ethical dilemma, where we have kind of like a nihilistic framework, where we only have like a nihilistic framework to go off of. Right? And we've talked about this a lot on the show before, about how, you know, rationality is not a one-stop shop, and how, like, you know, eggheads versus salt of the earth hero types, and, you know, the salt of the earth guy kind of wins. Like, there's this kind of lingering human truth, which is like, there's no way that human beings can actually fully unpack what the right thing is to do is through rationality. It's more of a feeling thing, and there is no baseline moral code upon which, you know, moral choices can be derived, and language is useless. We need symbols, we need, you know, feelings and emotion to really get a sense of what our gut thinks is the right thing to do. And you need some kind of criteria or ideology or framework to direct our thinking when we make moral choices. And those are inevitably biased, or they, you know, they come from a place of social conditioning, or da 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 da. But what I think is really powerful about this film, and I'd never seen this film before until this week, and I was so moved by it, is that rationality fails even when we do have those frameworks, even when we do have those criteria, despite, you know, forgetting nihilism, right? Even if we do have very clear parameters upon which we can base our moral decision making, it still fails us, right? So in this film, we've got a very clear goal. It's not like a nihilistic situation. The people want to save the earth. It's a very clear goal. And not only that, that goal is a noble goal. It's the most noble, the most important goal you can think of. Making sure the sun continues to exist so that the earth can continue to survive, right? This is the most constant, right? This is the most, like, important goal a person can have. And on top of that, the people making these decisions are extremely intelligent people and the most rational people you can think of. So we're in a very archetypal territory, but even still, they make the wrong choices. So what are the implications of that? Well, I guess if we didn't know it already, human beings are really bad at knowing what the right thing to do is. And we're really bad at knowing who good people are. For example, I think the Chris Evans character is really important in this film. If you haven't seen it, he does have a lot of sort of undesirable qualities throughout. Like, he's very blunt, he's very rude, he's very aggressive. He's always like, he's a bit of a macho man. But notwithstanding all that stuff, you do sort of feel like he might come good if given the chance to actually sort of walk the walk rather than just talk the talk. And I don't want to give any spoilers away, because if you haven't seen the film, I really do implore you to watch it. As I said, I'd never seen it before this week, and I was really moved by it, particularly a scene that he's in where you see this guy who hasn't really been very well liked this whole time, but still does the thing that really isn't going to be great for him, let's put it that way. But he does it anyway, and there is, we've talked about this a lot, about that the archetypal hero, someone who does the right thing even when it doesn't bring them any kudos, you know, it doesn't bring them any credit or any social clout. You do it for the sake of your fellow man, you just do it anyway. And kind of this sort of draws me to the main point that I'm trying to make, considering, you know, the path that his character goes down throughout the entirety of the film, which is that we can't really know the validity or the justness of an act or a decision until we trace it all the way to the most important goal, the most important ideal. That is to say that we can't, like, unless we think about the most important thing that matters in the world, which is, let's say, like, the preservation of the human race, we can't really know whether a given thing that we're doing today or this morning or something is actually a good or a bad thing. Like, consider an everyday choice, right? Deciding, you know, whether to exercise today or something like that. Like, you can kind of take a guess about whether it's good or bad for your health, but you can't really know that all the way down the track, thousands of years from now, that's going to have a net benefit impact on the human race, right? You can never know those sorts of things, right? And on top of that, if you think about it, like, we never really do think about the things that far anyway. Like, we never really empathize past our line of sight. And in fact, we often actually change our view on whether something, I mean, 99% of people change their view on whether something is a good or a bad thing based on how it affects them. So like anything in politics, basically, when people are the ones that are the ones fronting the cost for something, they very rarely like it. That's very often the case. And so if we go back to a movie like Gattaca, right, the sort of Orwellianness of Gattaca kind of changes a little bit, or like the worth of that Orwellianness, or no, I shouldn't say Orwellianness because it's not a central authority, I said that at the start, but the dystopianness of that, we can kind of start to reconsider, and I don't want to sound like a psychopath here, but you kind of can start to reconsider the validity of it all when you start to think about the degree to which that's actually going to save lives in the future. Like, where are those rockets actually going? If it is the case that those rockets are going to save the human race, well, maybe it's a good thing that they're categorizing people in a certain way to make sure that they can do that. It's just an interesting ethical dilemma to sit in, right? Would you personally change your mind on all that and the way that the company like Gattaca goes about its business if it was your kids or if it was you that was being saved by that organization, for example? Now, compounding this, the film also shows us how the tiniest decision can decide the biggest issue humanity ever faces, right? The film is in a lot of ways like an exploration of magnification, of intensification, or blowing things out to show their true proportions. So there's a good example of this where they're deciding whether to go off course by 1 degree. And literally 1 degree, one singular degree in their trajectory changes the entire course of the film. Like it's a study in proportionality, right? So even in making like a little choice about like whether you should exercise or not, at the time it might feel so small, but in the long run, that could be the thing, in the rub, in the wash, that could be the thing that makes all the difference for humanity. We can never know in the moment. So I guess what we say is that therefore there's no way that there aren't going to be massive costs to this, are there, right? There has to be, because if so much can go wrong, right, from the turn of a dime, right, particularly considering sort of how our humanity faces up when we're in such a relentless and indifferent universe, right? Where nature itself, which is something that we both depend on, but we also fear, and that's the concept of sunshine itself in the film. Yeah, the sun is both the giver and taker of life in this film. But when you've got things like humanity in the face, and what I mean by humanity is sort of like a thing like caring for others in the face of in the face of having to save the greater good and everything like that. It reminds me of that episode of Black Mirror, actually, Metalhead, if you've seen that one with the dogs and how they, because they have no sense of humanity, if you took two equally competent warriors, the one that has less empathy is kind of going to be the one that has less humanity is going to be that's going to be the difference kind of thing. But there's clearly going to be a massive cost to all of this. If every little decision, every little one could potentially alter the big picture at the end, there's going to be some massive cost, and hopefully it's not the big massive cost, which is the end of civilization. So bringing all that together, if decision-making is so hard and the risks of bad decisions are so bad, even if they are just tiny little bad decisions, how the heck do we decide anything, particularly in the existential realm, right? Is there a perspective that we can consider that reconciles all of that? Well, at this point, I think it's worth that we move on to our third and final film for today, and this would be Christopher Nolan's film Interstellar from 2014. And it's got a very similar premise. The Earth is dying and these characters have to go out into space to save it, and they don't even know why or where they're going, but they're trying to move the Earth to another planet so that we can keep going elsewhere. But I want to talk about how Interstellar is different to a film like Sunshine. Because it still has all those same concepts of little tiny decisions have massive expansive consequences, and we can't really know the validity of any little decision until much later in the film when the true costs are bearing themselves. But I think this film is different in its what I've called its Nolan-ness. And what I mean by that is Christopher Nolan is clearly not just obsessed with time, but entropy and the direction of time. Like from the beginning, you've got Memento, and none of this is original. You can go on any YouTube essay about cinema and you'll find people saying the same thing, but it's important for the point I'm trying to make, which is that if you go back to his first film, Memento is about a guy sort of going back in time, or he's going forward in time, but he's retracing his steps. Of course, you've got Interstellar, you've got Dunkirk, which has got experiences of time being similar over different periods of time. You've then got Tenet, which is again about the idea of going back in time, or thinking about time going backwards and thinking about it, going in two directions, or thinking about it in a non-linear way specifically. And then Obviously, Oppenheimer hasn't come out yet, but I feel like building off the themes raised in Tenet, and I've talked about Tenet on the show, and I'm going to sort of bring some of the themes I've talked about Tenet before on the show up when you talk about Interstellar. But Oppenheimer, I think Oppenheimer is probably going to build off a lot of what Tenet is about, you know, with things like World War III and nuclear bombs and things like that. And really a story about the link between the past and the present and the future, specifically in the context of a potential nuclear apocalypse. And even in a film like Inception, which is probably less about time than his other films, the theme music is called Time. Even though it's not directed by Christopher Nolan, I think the film Arrival, which is very often compared to Interstellar, very similar films, is again about time and the non-linear structure of time. But I don't want to get too much into it because it's a great film and I want to talk about it probably separately. But I want to talk about how Interstellar, I think it's almost like the epitome of what Nolan's been trying to do all over all these years, because like in Tenet, he's trying to conceive or imagine the human experience as something that we can kind of speak to the ghosts of the future, right? And they literally use the word ghosts in the film. And by ghosts, they kind of mean like the image or the trace of somebody that doesn't physically exist in the present. Or they kind of do. It's a very sort of Derridean absence-presence thing, simultaneous absence-presence thing, where we can learn what to do in the present by listening to future voices speaking back to us, right? And not only is this a nice idea, but in Interstellar, he kind of scientifies it, which is to say that kind of if you think about the world in a five-dimensional way, if you think of reality being one where all moments in time can be observed or considered simultaneously in the present, whatever that is. We can understand time as something that, you know, even though we experience it linearly, we have memories and we have guesses about what the future brings and we can predict things. And so there is actually a scientific, quantifiable way of thinking about the history of the universe where we're sort of seeing everything simultaneously and not feeling too limited by the present and the constraints of the present and the things that we don't know right now. We can kind of think that there's information yet to be known that we can kind of know. I mean, there's things that we learn that we can guess, that we can theorize, that we can use rationality to understand without actually experimenting. We can know things without actually seeing them in reality first. So what's the rub here? Well, perhaps we need to sort of solve the problems of the present by listening to the clues of those that are calling back to us from the future. But if we recall Sunshine, right, we do sort of live in this world of nihilism, a world of bounded rationality. And so this sort of lifts up this question of, well, what voices, right? Well, how do we listen to these voices? And there's actually a few characters in Interstellar that I think embody the wrong kinds of voices or voices that at a time are kind of making very good points or are actually understanding all the things that I've already said, but say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. You know, by the end of the film, we know that they've actually said and done the wrong thing. So when I say recalling Sunshine, we talk about that idea of, in that film, there's lots of different perspectives, lots of different people, lots of different dilemmas. They all are very intelligent, but they still make the wrong choices. Even with all that information, all the parameters, they still make the wrong choices. And we see the Michael Caine character, for example, in Interstellar, who's kind of like the smartest guy in the whole movie, but he's trying to be practical. He's trying to think about, you know, what's the most efficient, what's the most effective way that we can preserve the human nature. And he's probably like a Gattaca guy, right? He's probably like a guy that's like, well, let's just, you know, someone's going to have to bear the cost here. Someone else has to do it. And similarly, you've got the Matt Damon character whose name is Man. And I think that's a really interesting choice of calling him Man because, I mean, the obvious thing is that he's Man. But the whole thing with him is that he's a guy that uses survival, the survival instinct as his basic fundamental framework. So as to say that, you know, human beings have always survived by trying to survive as individuals. And if everyone indulges that and embraces that, that's going to be the only way that we can progress. It's the way that we've progressed so far. And it's the only way that we should do that. And so I guess we've got all these different proponents of different ideologies, different influences, things that inform their decision-making in this very dark, nihilistic situation. You've got kind of like the Michael Caine character, you could say sort of like a practical realist or something like that. And man kind of has this sort of like eugenicist kind of, not so much eugenics, but like this sort of natural selection kind of thing. What the film actually ends up saying, though, really interestingly kind of links in with Everything Everywhere All at Once, really interesting, which is a film that I do appreciate how it very much embraces nihilism as this and existentialism as a constant threat and something that we ought to consider and ought to confront, because it's definitely something that we do fear, and I'm glad that it's brought that to the fore and brought that into the public square, I guess you could say. But what both these films kind of say, and Interstellar certainly says it quite explicitly, is that it seems that for some reason, right, love is this sort of fundamental benevolent force in the universe that we all like, we all trust for some reason. We don't know why, but for some reason, as a race, we're very often rewarded for promoting and embodying it. And which is, of course, what happens in the film. And no one is ever punished in life for loving, for truly loving, right? You might have to sacrifice in loving, but no one is ever viewed poorly, and good things happen when we love each other properly, right? When we do it in a way that is, it can be a dangerous thing in certain times, but love, for some reason, has this kind of undying and eternal benevolence. So it's almost like when we're trying to listen to the future voices, we can't just listen to them, you know, from a point of a survivalist point of view, or from a practical, realistic point of view. We have to kind of listen to those voices that are calling to us from a place of love, right? And that's what happens between Matthew McConaughey and his daughter Murphy. And of course, she's called Murphy because, you know, Murphy's Law, you know, all things are possible. And it's a bit like that Everything Everywhere All at Once idea, like in this place of darkness, and anything is possible, and everything could happen. How do you know where to look? Well, love kind of gives you the path in a kind of weird kind of way. So let's bring everything together this week. It's been a very abstract week. Let's try and hone it in, right? Human innovation can lead to a pretty hellish dystopian society, right? One that we're pretty much kind of seeing now in a lot of scary ways, and a lot of overly Orwellian, authoritarian, totalitarian societies. I'm not going to name them, but I think you can think of a couple. So wanting to progress the human race, wanting to advance civilization can be a very dangerous task, and people are definitely going to have to front up to some costs. There's going to be some serious sacrifices if we do it. But we all kind of end up seeing some of the merits of that, seeing the merits of sacrifice when push comes to shove, when we start to realize that at the end, if we look at that end goal, if we look at that ideal, if we look at what's at the end of the track, that's a pretty scary trajectory to be heading. And maybe a couple of us do need to make sacrifices right now. And it's really hard, but it is very hard to know who, and it's very hard to know who to throw under the bus. And that's how you get dictators, and you get fascists and totalitarian states, because people think that they have a certain idea of who ought to take the sacrifice for the greater good, make the sacrifice for the greater good. So in order to avoid that, maybe we need to think about it in a different kind of way. Maybe we need to view the direction, maybe we need to rethink the direction that we're heading, right? We could think of ourselves as explorers, right, sitting in the cockpit of a rocket and counting down from 10, and we're the ones in the driver's seats, right? We could be, you know, the Stalin or the Hitler or the Mao or whatever. Or we could open up our ears and try and hear the pings of future humans, who are maybe way out in space, way out in the ether, who have solved all of the mysteries that are currently holding us hostage and making us feel so anxious. So I suppose another way of putting it is that maybe it's not a matter of preparing for liftoff, but rather feeling the love from those who already have. Well, unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema. I've been your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX FM. But also consider jumping onto our website. Consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show. It would all be very much appreciated. But until next week, thanks so much for tuning in. Get in contact with me, and we'll see you next week.